we're so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
Yeah, the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to the Animal Voices Show, Western Canada's only radio program focusing on animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is CFRO 100.5 FM Co-op Radio, Vancouver, Canada. Today is Friday, September the 9th, 2016. I am your host, Jen Dobell, and I'm joined in studio today by my co-hosts, Allison Cole.
Hi there.
And Shauna Smith.
Hi.
Welcome, everyone. Today we are discussing animals in captivity, namely at aquariums. We have two feature interviews. Phil Demers, a former Marineland trainer turned whistleblower, discusses his lawsuit by Marineland and his experiences working at the Ontario facility. Then we will speak to Vancouverite Dr. Jeff Matthews, a conservationist, writer, scientist, and animal rights advocate. Dr. Matthews will discuss the Vancouver Aquarium's ethics and practices from his scientific perspective. And Shauna, you have some events for us.
The Earthlings documentary is being screened at Creekside Community Center this Saturday at 6:30 p.m. Snacks will be provided by Eternal Abundance, and the entire evening is free. We know how powerful documentaries can be, and countless lives have been transformed forever by this documentary. If you are unable to attend the screening, you can find this film on YouTube. This Sunday marks the first Vancouver march to close all slaughterhouses. The campaign started in France in 2012, and thousands of people have marched annually in over a dozen cities globally in hopes of bringing light to the suffering and exploitation of animals. Animals are not merely a commodity to be bought and sold, and there exists no humane way to enslave and violently murder anyone. This is a march in opposition and complete rejection of speciesism. The belief that merely being human entitles us to dictate the lives of other beings without any regard for their suffering. In recent years, much progress has been made within the animal rights movement, and further change will be foreseeable with collective actions such as this march. The March to Close All Slaughterhouses takes place in Vancouver at noon this Sunday, beginning at the Vancouver Art Gallery. Please wear a red shirt. We will have signs available, but you are welcome to bring your own. This is a peaceful, family-friendly march. You may also bring instruments such as vegan drums that are synthetic, tambourines, cowbells, shakers, and anything else that can be used to make noise and help us march to a beat. Let's get rhythmic. You may find details on Vancouver on Facebook at Vancouver March to Close All Slaughterhouses. Please share this event proudly and widely to vegans and non-vegans. All are welcome. If you have any animal-friendly events that you would like to have announced on the show, please send us an email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com or post it on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver.
Thank you, Shauna.
Every weekday from 7 to 8 a.m., Media Mornings brings you independent news and culture you won't hear anywhere else.
Daily headlines, interviews, countless local voices, and our Latin America report help you make sense of today's news. Coast Salish territories and global affairs.
Guests include David Suzuki.
Media become hostages of the corporate agenda. And thank God for the independents like you.
Indigenous activists like Pam Palmater.
This kind of radio show helps inform Indigenous and non-Indigenous people and hopefully inspire our Indigenous citizens to take action.
Social justice advocates like Maude Barlow.
We are continue to be America's gas tank, although now we want to be the gas tank for the world.
Artists like Kenny Starr.
Change is created by lots of different types of activists.
Ray Spoon.
Gender is limiting and affecting everyone.
And authors like Michael Parenti.
The state is at the service of these corporations.
So tune in to Media Mornings, weekdays 7 to 8 a.m.
on Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM and podcasting at w2media.ca.
So today I have the pleasure of interviewing Phil Demers, who is a former Marineland trainer turned whistleblower. And welcome to the show, Phil. Thanks for making time for us.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
So can you give our listeners an overview of your history with Marineland, how long you were there, which animals you worked with?
Certainly. I began in the year 2000 as a 22-year-old boy. I left in 2012, a 34-year-old man. When I began, I was just like anyone else, scrubbing buckets, learning to feed the animals and, of course, how to train them. And over time, eventually, it was my responsibility to oversee much of the species of animals, many of them rather, including belugas, orcas I worked with, of course, dolphins, seals, sea lions, walruses. Yeah, you name it, I did it.
And what lies were the employees told to repeat to guests of the park in your training?
Well, the problem with it being considered lies is that at the time, we of course didn't know it was lies. The real education for me started after I left Marineland, but while we were employed in-house, we believed ourselves to be the experts, and we took whatever information Marineland provided as expertise. And so as far as the misinformation that we were given, I guess the easiest way to summarize it is that all of the information we were giving, aside from perhaps the number of teeth the animals or the whales may have, beyond that, everything was an extension of half-truths, something that was ultimately meant to serve the industry.
Right, so it would be things like how long animals survive in captivity versus the truth of the wild, which would be longer typically, would you say?
Absolutely, everything.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any more examples of lies that you later learned were actual lies that you had to repeat?
We just generally kept any type of sensitive information from getting to the public. So in and of itself, that is a lie, because what we would do is misinform any type of people that were asking informed questions. So as far as examples go, certainly where we acquired the animals, obviously how long they live, people would often ask whether or not the animals were healthy and well taken care of. Of course, this would be our answer would be a glaring lie to anyone who knows anything about Marineland's history and past, much of which of course has become unearthed since 2012. But again, much of the information we didn't know as lies, and also as a paid employee, I was a company man, so I didn't question a lot of the policies and procedures that went on over there. I just assumed someone knew what was going on, and my job was to just keep propagating that information and trying to keep Marineland as successful as possible as a business.
And speaking of the question of are the animals being well taken care of and healthy, that makes me think about the vet care. Did they have numerous on-site vets full-time, or were they called in periodically? How did that work?
Well, when I started, there was no vet in-house. There was one that we periodically called, and there was one that we consulted with in California. But all of the medical procedures were performed by ourselves and, from a liaison from afar. Eventually, one consulting vet came to work occasionally, a day or two a week, and then eventually they would hire a young veterinarian that was going to be a full-time staff member. But from the best of my knowledge, since 2012, both vets are no longer there.
In your opinion, would you say that it was necessary to have a full-time vet on hand, that maybe you were all not properly trained enough to be doing these procedures? Or
I would say that they probably required more on-staff veterinarians. I think the role of a veterinarian should be that of one looking after the best interests of the animal. I can't say that was necessarily the case. Not to suggest that these vets were bad people. So, I mean, they were arguably my best friends at the time, but certainly there's no lack of need for more care and attention.
Mm-hmm.
But I should say that in my experience, the veterinarian served more as a means to acquire drugs than necessarily enhance the lives of the animals themselves.
Well, speaking of drugs, to your knowledge, were any of the animals on antipsychotics or antidepressants? I've heard that this is common in this industry.
Oh, absolutely. The majority of the animals at some point would be on Valium or different types of psychotics, the pinnipeds especially, walruses especially. And, of course, the killer whale wasn't immune to this either. She was put on various forms of psychotics. And, the vets, and rather Marineland as a whole's answer to aggressive animals was always to simply drug them. And as you know, in the wild, or especially in an unnatural environment, wild animals tend to get fairly aggressive with each other. So the use of drugs was what I would deem rampant.
Mm-hmm. Was it your job to be giving that to them as well?
Oh, absolutely. In many cases, I was diagnosing the animals and coming up with and suggesting doses to the vets.
Oh, that's heartbreaking. Well, let's talk about the slap suits against you and the others. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that?
Certainly. So Marineland has a very litigious history. They like to sue anyone who expresses any type of opposition to the park, and no one's immune. And so they've launched a series of lawsuits against media, activists, former employees, none of which are legitimate, none of which are tangible, and none of which really would hold up or would serve Marineland the purpose they purport to serve, which is to gain, you know, to recoup economical losses that we, of course, have imposed on Marineland in such a malicious way as they like to paint it.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, strategically, Marineland has kept these lawsuits out of the courtrooms and prefer instead to try to bleed us financially. I mean, we've amassed over $100,000 worth of legal bills, and we've not actually moved forward in any capacity with our lawsuits. And so thankfully, last week, we were appointed a case management judge because a judge finally looked at our case and said, okay, something's amiss here. Something, of course, we've been kicking and screaming about for a long time. But as per the design of the court system, justice takes a long time and is very expensive. And that is Marineland's sole strategy. None of these lawsuits will be taken to trial. None of them.
Mm-hmm. So are you feeling generally not that concerned about the lawsuits?
Oh, no, it's debilitating, psychologically and emotionally debilitating. I mean, there's a campaign of harassment against us that I can't even really summarize into words. We've had our home stalked. We've been followed by private investigators. We've had threats of violence made against us. We've had the police called and sent to our homes. I mean, I've had the police come to my home because I retweeted Canadian comedian Kenny Hotz from the Kenny versus Benny show. I mean, the absurdity of this campaign knows no bounds, but this is Marineland's sole intention. I'm dangerous to them, so they want to impose upon me the threat of danger as well.
This sounds like it's really affecting your daily life.
Yeah, I would say that's a fair mm-hmm. assessment.
Yeah.
I mean, for the 24 hours that in a day that I live and breathe, 23 hours and 59 minutes are all consuming with these lawsuits.
Right. How are the others doing? Tell us about the others who have been served these slap suits. And what are the charges for all of you?
Well, they're all intentional economical interference. They're all defamation suits, which is a classic slap suit. The slap suit being the acronym Strategic Lawsuit Against Public Participation. They're just meant by design to stifle public debate. You know, I largely am the face of this campaign, and so I've been, you know, raising money for all the other whistleblowers. So I guess you can say I've been largely, like, carrying the weight for them. But other activists are standing on their own, of course. Mike Garrett is a good dude. We've become good friends through all this. He's certainly holding his own. And really, the rest of the lawsuits have fallen by the wayside because the people went silent. The Toronto Star went silent. Other members of the media went silent. And so Marineland doesn't pursue these because, again, that is their sole intention, to stifle public debate and to silent opposition. And so once they achieve that, they don't actually pursue the lawsuits. We, on the other hand, proved to be a little more stubborn. And my end game goal is to go to trial because when we eventually go to discovery, I think that Marineland will have plenty of reason to want to keep some of the information they have away from the public, and it's my intention to expose that. I want that out there.
Well, I'm really thankful that you're so brave and willing to put up with all of this.
You're
bullying.
Too kind.
It's bullying.
Always. It's bullying, absolutely. Classic bullying.
Yeah, I mean, first they bully the animals, and then they bully the people that speak out about it. But thank you so much.
Well, the people know this and they see it, so I thank the people for being conscious of what's going on and being willing to listen.
Well, you know, speaking of what the people know, I don't know if you're aware, but I'm an animal rights activist as well, and one of my main campaigns is against the Vancouver Aquarium. I work for the director of the film Vancouver Aquarium Uncovered, and as you know, there is a court case on that. And I find that the general public that I speak with is completely humane washed by these facilities, and the number one defenses that I hear from parents when I speak to them about taking their children here, I'll give you the top three. It's educational. The animals are protected from predators in these facilities, and these facilities teach children to love and respect animals. And what would you say to these types of defenses? Because to me, that's the majority of the opinion out there.
Yeah, we don't have that opinion quite so much here in Niagara, because Marineland has not so much as donated a single solitary dime to conservation, whereas Vancouver Aquarium managed to sort of greenwash their whole operation. So, but nonetheless, I think what I tell people is when you go to see these places, what you're actually doing is supporting the depletion of wild stocks, because that's where these animals are from. And what you're witnessing is a semblance, a mere semblance of a wild animal, because those animals, these animals that inhabit these facilities now, are greatly compromised. They are not, you're not getting a good representation of what these animals actually are in the wild. These animals in captivity are drugged. They're stressed. Their lives are shortened, of course. They live under a constant state of duress. So any education that you get from that is an example of bad education. It would be no different than trying to learn about humans and observing them in prisons. So you're not seeing natural conditions. You're not seeing good social hierarchies and social bonds. And these are all broken. These animals are broken. So, you know, I implore people when they go there to take this information and go see for themselves. And more often than not, they come out of these places saying, hey, you were right. I regret giving my money, but now I'm going to save someone else from spending it. So, it's a necessary evil for certain people to go in and see things for themselves.
Mm-hmm. I always recommend the DVD series Planet Earth. Have you seen those?
Yeah, fantastic. I mean,
you see animals in the wild doing all their natural behaviors, and there's no way we could ever see that without those helicopter films that they made. Those were incredible.
And with technology today, I mean, you're a mere click of the button away from seeing animals in the wild. There are live feeds out there. There are, you know, there's endless amounts of videos, documentaries, et cetera, out there. The time, you know, zoos used to call themselves, you know, a necessary thing, because this was the only way to engage people and have them see these animals. But again, you're not seeing healthy populations of animals or healthy animals individually for that matter. And moreover, it's just too easy to and economical to see them in the wild now. So why support these places?
And, you know, I also say to people, children have a very excited viewpoint of dinosaurs. They know a lot about them. I don't know any kid that doesn't love them, and they've never seen one. They probably could tell you more facts about them as well than the animals that they're seeing in captivity.
Yeah, you nailed it. Ain't that the truth?
And when I go, I remember when I went to a zoo when I was a kid, my number one priority was waiting till the staff weren't looking at me so I could throw popcorn to the monkeys in the hopes that they would come close enough for me to touch them, and hoping a peacock would get close enough that I could pull off one of its tail feathers to put in my bedroom.
Well, in reality, if you think about that, that's a form of harassment, if you will, but this is the type of behavior that zoos solicit. I mean, just recently we had a young child fall into a gorilla exhibit. Well, the child just wanted to get closer, and now we've got a dead primate. So this is the type of poor education that zoos sort of solicit.
I was at the top of Grouse Mountain last weekend looking at the sad bears in captivity there, and this child next to me who was old enough to know better kept begging its mother to let it go in and pet the bear, and the mother did not say, "You can't do that, that's a wild animal." She just sat there, and I was so infuriated with the lack of education from parents around these types of scenarios.
It really does boil down to parents and making the choice. I'm often told, you know, Phil, you don't get it. You don't have children, so, you know, we'll do anything for our children. But what I like to refute that with is, I may not have children, but the closest thing I ever had to children were those animals at Marineland. So I understand the powerful bond between, myself and another vulnerable being. So for them to suggest that I don't know what it's like, well, maybe they should consider my perspective.
Right. I think you're just giving in to children's every need. If that's what you think you're doing is giving them what they want when it's not necessarily a good thing. I think that's bad parenting, and I don't need to have a kid to say that. I don't care what somebody says.
It doesn't serve them well in the future, that's for sure, because eventually, and I certainly don't implore that people do this, but, you know, children that are visiting these facilities too often get shamed when they go to school because the other kids that sort of know better or that, you know, have managed to learn truth about it are too eager to speak out and tell these kids, like, no, what you did was supported animal cruelty.
That's awesome. I don't know what percentage of the classes would have kids that would speak down to the other kids who are supporting that, but I hope that's a growing trend for sure.
Well, around here, it's quite a bit, but again, Marineland's history is pretty grotesque, and, you know, we've sort of unearthed a lot and continue to, so not information that can be simply ignored.
Right. Well, just on another topic now, I'm wondering, do you still have any connections with current staff at Marineland?
That's a question Marineland's lawyer would love to ask me, and I'll reserve that answer for him if and when that time comes. But it should be noted that most, if not all, of Marineland's employees, seasonal as well, are forced to sign non-disclosure agreements. So if there were to be any type of in-park sources, they would have to be very brave individuals.
And I would think they would probably even be leaving there if that was how they felt anyway, like you did.
I mean, it's your only choice once you turn a certain corner.
Mm-hmm. How are the others doing with their slap suit situations? Are you all, I mean, yourself included, are you all living in your parents' basements now because of these legal bills? What are you doing with yourselves?
Well, thankfully, my voice has been loud enough that I've managed to cover most of the legal bills. Of course, I never know when I'm going to get another one. But, you know, podcasts such as this one and radio, I just finished, in fact, going to a radio station. They're always all too happy to sort of support us and help us. So while it's tumultuous, to say the least, and don't get me wrong, it's never easy. We've been very lucky.
That's good. Well, I just wanted to ask if you wanted to let the public know if there's any way that we can support you. I think you have a website. Do you want to mention that?
Yeah, certainly. We have a fundraiser, an online fundraiser. You can visit savesmooshy.com. Certainly follow me on Twitter. My handle is one word, Walrus Whisperer. And, you know, add me on Facebook, whatever. I'm an open book. I'm easy to get in touch with. And those are sort of my driving forces is the social media. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, definitely join the network. We're doing nothing but growing.
Well, speaking of Facebook, I do follow your posts frequently. And even right now, there's a concern with a walrus that's underweight and a deer that seems to have an injured leg that's not being attended to. Do you want to talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, certainly. Back in 2011, I got into a heated argument with the owner of Marineland, where which he deemed me a problem employee. And the subject of that argument was, in fact, Zeus the walrus. Of course, in 2012, the Toronto Star wrote extensively about the conditions at Marineland. 15 former employees spoke out, one of which, not myself, spoke about Zeus. And that was the reason why she, in fact, quit, was seeing just how bad his health had been deteriorated. And bear in mind, this is in 2012. So I had been recently challenging Marineland to produce a video of Zeus, of which they, of course, ignored. And when they did produce anything, it was a carefully crafted photo, largely hiding his body. So essentially, we got our own video of Zeus. And as you can imagine, his condition is just worsened so much so that he's just so grossly emaciated now. He doesn't even look like, I mean, some people are even wondering, asking, is that a walrus? So on one hand, we feel vindicated in that all we've ever told is the truth. But on the other hand, it sinks your heart in your stomach seeing that this animal's suffering continues unimpededly, and he's surely going to die. As for that deer, Marineland actually gave another laughable excuse, suggesting that much like a beachgoer, with a pebble in his shoe. The deer is merely hobbled by a pebble in its hoofs, which...
Oh, my God.
I of course, call BS. There's no way of knowing what happened to that deer. That video was actually taken months ago. I just sort of sat on it for a while. I didn't want to, you know, I wanted to pick my spots as to when to reveal it and provide it. Did so last week. Of course, it's getting a lot of views. It's getting some media attention. I know historically, animals such as deer are certainly not worth investing much money in caring for them, medicine, etc. So if I had to assume what happened to that deer, is that it's probably buried out back in the mass graves.
Can you talk a little bit about that mass grave?
Certainly. So Marineland's just been burying animals en masse, if you will, at the back of the park. And, of course, the Toronto Star investigation sort of unearthed that fact. And, you know, it was revealed that there's thousands of animals back there. Unfortunately, places like Marineland see animals as disposable. It's cheaper for them to simply replace them than to properly care for them. And so more animals wind up back there. My efforts, of course, is trying to keep animals from getting there. And that's what we're doing today. We're just trying to keep that from filling up.
So in regards to the animals that aren't getting the care they need, such as the walrus and the deer, I actually contacted the College of Veterinarians of Ontario, and I'm sure it's no surprise to you that they said it was not a concern. And have you done that as well, and what was your response from them?
I did. They threatened to subpoena me because at the time I was trying to protect certain individuals, and I said, well, subpoena me. Although I did become... I mean, throughout this entire thing, I've done nothing but been helpful to the process, be it from CASA, the Canadian Association of Zoos and Aquariums, or the College of Veterinarians. I've been nothing but forthright with them. And in the end, time after time, it just these places just proved to be associations looking to mitigate the damage and or protect their due-paying members, of which, of course, Marineland is a member of CASA, and the veterinarians are, of course, members of the college. So I don't have a lot of faith in the system. In fact, I'm countersuing Marineland for abuse of process, because every which corner we've turned, they've managed to, in my estimation, abuse and leverage their powers to the system.
Okay. Well, this is all really great information, and I encourage the public to check out your Twitter, Facebook, and the website, and also to contribute some legal funds for all of you. Thank you so much for what you're doing, Phil. You're really brave, and we do need people like you to speak out.
I appreciate it. Anytime.
Okay. Take care. I'll talk to you soon. Stay strong. Thanks.
Listening to Animal Voices on Vancouver's Co-op Radio 100.5 FM CFRO. 100% listener-sponsored radio broadcasting live from the east side on unceded Coast Salish territories.
And now for some news. In keeping in the theme of today, a baby sea otter was found on a beach and brought to the Seattle Aquarium. Apparently, he will be coming to the Vancouver Aquarium because the Seattle one doesn't have room for him. It was also mentioned in the Seattle Times that the Seattle Aquarium is considering pairing the otter with a surrogate mother, but decided against it, allegedly to get him to the Vancouver Aquarium faster. Animal rights groups are wondering why he was not considered for rehabilitation and release by local organizations such as Critter Care and the Wildlife Rescue Association, who rehabilitate orphaned otters and release them to the wild.
Do you know why he was taken to the Vancouver Aquarium? I'm curious about that.
I have not had time to look into this yet. It was brought to my attention by a couple of animal rights associates. But this is a situation that I am often very suspicious of when it comes to facilities that claim to be rescue, research, and release facilities. I always want to know more. I'm the kind of person that digs a little bit deeper. And while it may be true that an animal is not releasable, I think often there's situations where the animal is not actually given that chance, whether it be because it becomes too habituated to humans while it's in their care, which is something that rescue workers should know not to do. And perhaps sometimes even not giving an animal a chance at release at all when experts would agree that there's absolutely no reason not to. I think we've all heard stories like that, right?
Yeah, for sure. I know that, unfortunately, the Vancouver Aquarium's pretty well known for not for rehabilitating, but keeping animals in captive, right? I know you know way more about that than I do, Jen.
Well, I always have to say when we talk about this topic with the Vancouver Aquarium specifically that we are not opposed to all that they do, but I am personally, and a lot of us are, opposed to a lot of what they do. They do have the Marine Mammal Rescue Center, and we acknowledge that that is good. We do wish that more funds were going toward it. And I personally don't feel that I have a lot of confidence in the actual aquarium itself when they talk about some of their animals being rescued. And if you've seen the documentary Vancouver Aquarium Uncovered, the animals that I'm specifically talking about right now are the dolphins. So I do recommend that you check out that documentary on YouTube. It is full of facts and full of information and quite surprising to the general public. And like I say, I just always dig a little bit deeper when it comes to any sanctuary calling itself a sanctuary in the world, any kind of animal, any zoo, any aquarium, and what they state as their mandate. I don't take anything at face value, especially when there's profits involved.
I think that's really well said, and we all need to be cautious and not listen to necessarily mainstream media, right? And that's why we're here, alternative media, to sort of dig deeper into these issues that aren't being covered by mainstream media. I really liked your the interview with Phil Demers when he was speaking about, you know, don't take things as face value because the staff at Marineland are being trained to say one thing, but not necessarily the truth.
Exactly.
And go ahead.
We have to be suspicious when anyone's given some kind of a contract to sign, whether they're volunteers or employees, asking them not to talk to the public about what, about what goes on there. That is strange to me. Why would that be?
You would hope there would be transparency.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I have a feeling it's like that with the Vancouver Aquarium too, when I've just from watching the film Vancouver Aquarium Uncovered, with some of the interviews there with some of the staff and not them giving straight answers.
Well, speaking of straight answers, I can't get anybody there to phone me or email me back despite multiple times calling
and
asking.
You've tried too much, that's why.
Sorry?
I think because you've tried too much. They're not prepared for this kind of questioning from the public.
Well, my questions were simple. I wanted to know where their animals came from and why they're in the facility. And that's not something they're willing to let me know about. And I was just talking to Dr. Matthews last night about something that makes me really sad is the octopus that's in captivity there. It's in such a small enclosure. And they're very intelligent. I think they have the intelligence of four-year-olds. And the animals that are living there do not have the space to run at full speed or swim at full speed. And I just don't agree with that. I don't think that they're all rescued. And it bothers me. Anyway, speaking of Dr. Matthews, we are now ready for his interview. And I think our listeners will find that very interesting.
I'm happy to have Dr. Jeff Matthews on the show today. Dr. Matthews is a scientist, conservationist, animal rights activist, and has written many informative news articles on the topic of animals in captivity, predominantly about the Vancouver Aquarium. Thanks for being here, Dr. Matthews.
My pleasure.
Let's begin by discussing your experience with the Vancouver Aquarium and captivity in general.
Yeah, I got involved in the anti-captivity movement about 4 years ago now. As a parent of a younger child, the aquarium is always one of the go-to places. So, when my son was younger, we used to go to the aquarium, and I never really gave it much thought until one day, as we were watching the dolphin show, and we were listening to them talk about how these were rescued animals, and then that these animals wouldn't survive in the wild, and that's why they were in the aquarium. And then watching them demonstrate acrobatic tricks and showing how fast they could swim, it occurred to me that something didn't add up. These animals looked perfectly healthy, and they were performing tricks, so it didn't seem right to me that they wouldn't be viable in the wild. So I did some digging on my own, and it turns out that when I discovered the belugas in particular, that some of them were wild caught, it really made me rethink the whole purpose of the aquariums. If they were misleading us about that, what else were they misleading us in? And really, once you get into the world of animal captivity and start looking at it and looking at the research that's been done, you realize that it's not very kind to these animals. And so that's where it all started being reevaluated. And since then, I've been digging into other of the messaging that the aquarium puts out, and trying to do what I can to help them clean up and be a better place.
And there are some current concerns about the type of donors who contribute to the Vancouver Aquarium, which seems to conflict with their mandate. Can you elaborate on this for our listeners?
Yeah, this is the part of the aquarium that I think is really unfortunate. They've managed to spend 20 years marketing themselves to the population in the Lower Mainland, that they are the premier ocean conservation organization, and they're all about research. But if you look at their partners gallery, the corporations that provide support and pay for, you know, these upgrades that they're doing and all the infrastructure of the aquarium, something's amiss. And you don't have to look much farther than their premier sponsor, Tech Mining. You know, this is a company that is responsible for, you know, one of the biggest environmental disasters in BC's history. I mean, they spent 100 years pouring arsenic, mercury, lead, and other heavy metals into the Columbia River. You know, they actually had to, they were forced to publicly admit this several years ago. And they admitted it, I think it was just a few months after they made a $12.5 million donation to the aquarium. And this is the kind of thing that the aquarium does. They market themselves to these corporations as, you know, associate yourself with us. And, you know, you take advantage of all the great feeling you get from our conservation activities, or, you know, their green image. And everywhere else, this is called greenwashing. And Tech isn't the only one. I mean, Shell is a major donor to the aquarium. They have been for several years. They're a major player in the tar sands. So while the aquarium is messaging about global warming, they're also taking money from companies like Shell. You know, shipping companies that are, you know, some of the largest fleets for oil and LNG tankers. They're donors. A group called BG Group. They specialize in deep water oil production and fracking. They're another major donor, and most recently, I think their most recent donor is Prince Rupert LNG, which is, to me, particularly egregious. What Prince Rupert LNG is proposing is a liquefied natural gas plant on Ridley Island. You've probably heard of Liliu Island, which is the subject of another application for an LNG plant, and First Nations in the area are, I think, they're occupying the site. They're trying to stop it because it will very likely destroy the Skeena River wild salmon that are going through there. That's a very sensitive estuary. It's a refuge for a wild salmon, and LNG plants on Liliu or Ridley Island will significantly impact the salmon stocks up there. And the Skeena River salmon are, you know, still largely doing well, unlike our Fraser River salmon. So we need to protect them. And for the aquarium to be taking money off a project like that, that puts, you know, one of our probably most cherished ocean resource, our salmon, at risk, to me, is just, it's unconscionable. So these are the type of people that the aquarium cozies up to. And, you know, it goes more than just taking money from them. But if you look at the aquarium's advocacy, there's very little of it in terms of these kinds of issues. We've never heard the aquarium come out against some of these LNG plants and the effects that they'll have on our ocean and our coastline. So, you know, what are they doing? If they want to market themselves as the premier ocean conservation organization, why aren't they standing up for these issues? Is it because they're taking money from these same companies? You know, Mount Polly is another great example. They take a lot of money from Tech Mining, large mining company. Yet after Mount Polly, there was not a word from the aquarium. There was no official response. They haven't shown up at any of the pipeline hearings. They're largely absent from this. And I have to wonder whether it's because they're taking money from all these same companies.
Right. And the documentary Vancouver Aquarium Uncovered exposed the minuscule amount of funding that the Marine Mammal Rescue Center receives. I believe it's less than 2% of the aquarium's total revenue that goes toward the Marine Mammal Rescue Center. As a biologist, do you feel that this is adequate for a so-called rescue and conservation facility?
You know, it's a $30 million a year organization, and most scientists I know don't see anywhere near that kind of money. You know, when you look at that in terms of captivity, you know, very recently there's been a push to create animal sanctuaries for ocean life, dolphins and whales. And you look at the National Aquarium in Baltimore, and they've just announced this incredible plan to move all of their captive dolphins into a seaside ocean pen sanctuary. It's a much better environment for them. They get some room to go. They actually get to taste real ocean water and you know, feel the rhythm of the tides for the first time in their lives in so long. You know, this is an expensive project. There's no question about it. It's not cheap to do that, but it is better for the animals. So while the aquarium is spending this pittance on research and whatever they're spending it on, they're spending $100 million on upgrading their facilities. $100 million could build a hell of an ocean sanctuary for their marine mammals. Yet that isn't even a consideration. The aquarium fights it at every turn. They have nothing good to say about sanctuaries. They say that they're dangerous. They're not good for the animals. It's just complete resistance. So, the numbers, the money that they're spending doesn't really add up in terms of how it relates to their mission. If their mission really is conservation, if they're really into marine mammal rescue, then they'll also, take the ones that maybe couldn't survive in the wild and put them in a place where they're not suffering. Because everything we've learned about these tiny little pools, that we see at aquariums and marine parks, the animals are suffering, psychological and it's physiological.
Right, and the opinion of the aquarium seems to be waning, especially after the release of the documentary Vancouver Aquarium Uncovered. Dr. Matthews, for years now, you've been highlighting these very issues. Are you under the impression that Mr. Nightingale and Mr. Wright, the aquarium CEO and vice president, respectively, are involved in animal exploitation?
Oh, there's no doubt about it. They absolutely are. They use the belugas. They use the dolphins, they're using their porpoises, they're using penguins now, not native to this region. There's no reason there for them to be there except if the aquarium wants to become some sort of zoo. So yes, they're making money off of these animals in captivity, and the animals are suffering while they do it. It's pretty simple, really.
And speaking of a zoo, they now have a manta ray petting pool where they have actually cut the barbs off the manta rays for human safety. And people who probably have sunscreen and bacteria on their hands are allowed to reach in and touch these sensitive animals. How do you feel about that as a biologist?
I have to confess I'm not up on manta ray anatomy. I don't really know that much about them. Instinctually, I think that the animals aren't having the best time of it. But it's it's very people focused, and people get a lot of emotion out of it, and I'm sure there's quite a bit of wonder involved in it. But I think there's an expense that the animals are paying. I don't think it's just one issue. With the aquarium, there's a lot of them. I remember when I would take my son there, the one exhibit that always made me cringe and I always had trouble looking at was the octopus, the giant Pacific octopus, because the glass case was no bigger than it was a little bigger than a home aquarium. And you'd never see the octopus. He would always be just within some rocks there, maybe you'd see one of his arms pointing out. But octopuses are highly intelligent animals. They can problem solve. You know, they need to be stimulated far more than they ever could be in such a small tank. And you know, then we hear stories about octopuses that manage to find a way out of their enclosures at other aquariums. And you know, once you see one of these animals in those terms, that, you know, it's a thinking, living, feeling, conscious being, you have to start looking at the other ones. And there's, you know, there's a lot of these animals that are probably not very well off and have some sort of, you know, psychosis or, you know, psychological damage being done to them all the time. They're not in a natural environment. They're not in an environment that evolution created them to be in. There's a lot of suffering that goes on at zoos and aquariums. And it's one of those hard things for people to grasp because, you know, even myself, it never even occurred to me at first because we're so trained by society to see animals as property, as something other than human. But once, you know, it's just like a switch, though. Once you get that feeling and once you see it in a couple animals, you know, you start extending it to others. And so, yeah, when you look around aquariums and zoos all over the world, there's a lot of suffering that goes on.
Yes.
And the aquarium included.
Absolutely. The octopus is one that makes me very sad as well. I read somewhere they have the intelligence of a 4-year-old. And I do remember that story where the octopus escaped from an aquarium out a drain pipe and back into the ocean. And I think that was just one of my happiest moments in life to read that article. It's my hope and sorry, carry on.
No, it's just, you know, it's one of those stories of triumph. It's like, you know, more and more recently we've been hearing stories about dolphins that have lived in captivity. Sam Powell was one, where he had been in captivity for several years, and the government ordered him released. So they had him in a sea pen to rehabilitate him, to teach him to fish, to get him used to the ocean. And he escaped 6 months to a year before he was supposed to be released. And a few months later, I think it was, scientists reported that they had found him with his original pod of dolphins that he originally came from, and happy living in the wild. And just recently, he was seen with young dolphins. So they figured that now he's become a parent. So there's many more success stories out there. Aquariums and zoos will deny that these animals can go back in the wild, and they'll do everything they can to keep them in captivity. But the fact of the matter is that they just don't try.
Right.
And I think if we try, we've got enough success stories out there. Rick O'Berry's done a lot of work promoting this, as is Lori Marino. But we can do it. It can happen. It's just that they need the investment and they need the motivation to do it.
So we need more public pressure and we need people to stop buying tickets to these archaic facilities, don't we?
Oh, absolutely. You know, money talks, especially for these organizations. That's what they're about.
Well, it's my hope and belief that animal liberation is the next great social movement. I'm seeing that people are increasingly becoming aware of the sentience and intelligence of animals, especially cetaceans in captivity. And documentaries such as The Cove, Blackfish, and Vancouver Aquarium Uncovered are necessary in exposing what these corporations want to keep hidden from the public. And we are not so easily misled and can see the difference between a true animal sanctuary where animals generally thrive and a profit-generating circus where the death rate tends to be high. I'm also noticing many parents and children boycotting these types of facilities now. Dr. Matthews, in your opinion, is the research performed by the Vancouver Aquarium benefiting wild populations, as they claim?
So, you know, the aquarium has two sides to it. You know, I don't want to say that everything they do is bad, because clearly it's not. You know, just the ocean cleanup that they do, where they get people out to clean up beaches every year, that's, you know, it's a good thing. It's hard to criticize that. It gets people out, it gets people near the ocean, and they're doing something good while they're doing it. So, you know, we can't say that everything the aquarium does is bad. What we can say is that one good thing doesn't justify another bad thing. In terms of research, you know, there's some good there too, in terms of the wild research that they've been doing. We know more about our southern resident killer whales than we would have if it hadn't been for research that the aquarium's done. We've learned a lot because of it. However, we haven't learned very much, you know, in the past couple of decades, we haven't learned very much about belugas or Pacific white-sided dolphins because of research that they've done on their captive animals. So there's a big distinction between the wild research that they do and the captive research they do. Much like any other zoo or aquarium, the research that they do on the captive animals is primarily to further captivity. You know, these animals get diseases that they don't get in the wild, and there's research that's done on that. They have behaviors that, you know, in these sort of tightly contained facilities, tightly managed lives that they have, don't really reflect wild behaviors all that much. There's you know, similarities, of course, but they don't get to forage for the food in captivity that they do in the wild. It's not something you can study. So much of the research that they're doing just goes to help keep these animals healthy in captivity. You know, years and years ago, when killer whales and other marine mammals first started coming into captivity, we knew nothing about them. So I think those early days were very different. There was a lot to learn about these animals. But most of that is done now. We understand. I think we've gotten everything we can from captive research, and now it's just a matter of you know, self-fulfilling research. The more you learn about these animals in captivity, the longer we can keep them in captivity alive. But even there, they, you know, they're failing to a large degree. If you look at the death rate of marine mammals at the aquarium, it's pretty egregious.
Right. And we don't have much time left in our interview, but I do just want to finish off by mentioning your wonderful son, Rain. He does not support cruelty toward animals. What do you say to parents who claim that visiting these facilities is necessary to inspire a passion for wildlife? What would Rain tell them?
Oh, he, you know, so he's my inspiration for all of this. I mean, I became a vegetarian because one day he said, you know, we went to feed him some meat, and he said, you know, why would he want to eat an animal? He's done. And it's because we teach our kids all these stories about happy animals, and then we tell them to go eat them. And then we go look at them in marine parks and zoos. So he's, you know, he's staunchly anti-captivity, but I learn as much from him as he learns from me. I think the key with all this is to listen to your kids. Because I've talked to a lot of kids that have visited the aquarium, and almost all of them, when you ask them, do you think the animals are happy? Almost all of them say no. And I think a lot of parents, you know, just sort of pass, you know, gloss over that. And I think it's something you should talk to your kids about. You know, ask them how they think these animals feel, and ask them, you know, if they could think of a better place for them, and just listen to them, engage with them about it, and, you know, you might learn something yourself, too.
Great. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today, Dr. Matthews. I really appreciate all that you've provided for our listeners today, and we'll talk to you soon.
Great. Thanks. I appreciate it.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Well, I hope you enjoyed our show, and I hope you learned a lot. You've been listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada. Please join us on our next show, Friday, September the 10th.
Friday, oh, sorry. September the 16th.
Allison, I'm going to let you do the outro.
Yeah, okay. So next week we're actually having our show for Elephant Appreciation Day, which is on September the 22nd. And it's also World Rhino Day on September the 22nd. So we're going to be having two elephant and rhino-themed interviews. The future interview will be with a semi-local filmmaker. She's from Victoria. Her name is Patricia Sims. And this interview is going to be on her very recent film called When Elephants Were Young, which is focusing on Asian elephants in Thailand. And then we'll also be having Fran Duthie on the show. She's the co-founder of Elephanatics, which is a local elephant advocacy organization, and she'll be speaking to us about African elephant issues and the upcoming march for elephants and rhinos that we'll be having here on September the 24th, and it's a global event as well. Okay, want to keep going? No? please tune in to Animal Voices. Animalvoices.org is where you can download our shows and check out our podcasts there. Please send us an email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com if you want to send us an email and let us know if you enjoy the show. And also please check out our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, and our Twitter on Animal Voices YVR. So we're going to be closing the show now with a song dedicated to all these animals in captivity, as we've been speaking about on the show today, particularly in aquariums. This song is called, what's it called here? Don't You Ever Get Tired of Hurting Me. It's by Jamie Johnson featuring Willie Nelson. Please stay tuned for Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith. And thank you for tuning in to Animal Voices today. Remember to be kind to the animals.
You make my eyes run over all the time. And you're happy when I'm out of my mind. And you don't love me, but you won't let me be. Don't you ever get tired of hurting me. Somebody must have hurt you long ago. But why take revenge on one who loves you so? Surely there's another way for you to be. Don't you ever get tired of hurting me. You must think that I look bad with a smile. For you haven't let me wear one in such a long, long while. Still I keep running back. Why must this be? Don't you ever get tired of hurting me. with a smile. For you haven't let me wear one in such a long, long while. Still I keep running back. Why must this be? Don't you ever get tired of hurting me? Don't you ever get tired of hurting me?